Coast to Coast.
This is Joel Reinberger.
Last week on Handball, we met Ted Dominey from Flowerpot, who has grown and studied cherries for basically his whole life, except for that 1 year that he spent being a police officer in New Guinea, strangely enough. Now, he has introduced us to his friend Peter Leshin, retired naval navigator who's part of the Village Green Project in Woodbridge. Peter, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joel. I'm very well. Thanks for the opportunity.
How did you feel when Ted asked you to be on the show?
Oh, I guess a little nervous, a little doubtful, but here we are.
Now, we've been talking about the relationship between the Navy and rum earlier this morning. When did you join the Navy and was rum a part of the daily life of a sailor at that point?
So I joined the Navy in 1974, and by that stage, at least in the Australian Navy, we had got rid of the rum issue. I can't remember exactly when that had gone, but it was certainly before I joined. But I do remember that in the New Zealand Navy, they did still have a rum issue at that stage.
Why do you think that rum, you know, or that alcohol as a general thing was so important in the Navy?
Well, I think you have to remember that people go away in a ship for long periods of time, so they've got to have some sort of normality in their life. And I think if you go back far enough to, say, Nelson's Navy, a bit of Dutch courage before going into battle was probably also rather important. So I think that's part of the story anyway.
Now, you did your schooling with the Navy, your Year 11 and 12. How did that come about?
Yes, so back in the early 70s and going back before that, you could join as an officer cadet very young. In fact, a few years before my time, you could join as a 13-year-old. By the time 1974, when I joined, the earliest you could join, I was actually about 15 and 9 months. And Navy took you into the Naval College at Jervis Bay and basically took you through your years 11 and 12 schooling before going on to university and so on. I think it was a bit like the old saying about the Jesuits, give me the boy for 7 years and I'll give you the man. You know, a bit of inculcation of naval ethos into very young people.
Was it a pretty normal college schooling or was there a lot of naval stuff in it?
Oh, it was a lot of naval training mixed in, but I was brought up in England. We emigrated when I was 14 to Melbourne, very like an English grammar school in many ways, lots of sport, cold swims in Jervis Bay first thing in the morning, that kind of thing. It was fairly tough.
Wow. Look, I know Jervis Bay. It's actually a rather lovely spot, isn't it?
It is, but as a cadet, you don't tend to notice that very much. They don't give you time.
Why did you become a navigator of all the things that you could possibly do in the Navy?
I guess I was just interested in navigation. Certainly, I'd made the decision I wanted to do that when I joined. I'd said that to the selection board at the time. Quite why, I'm not sure I can put my finger on. I mean, I didn't know much about it and what a naval navigator did. I sort of learnt that as I went along, but I never regretted it.
These days we tend to navigate by allowing a voice from our phone to say, turn left at the next exit. What was navigating like for you in the 70s?
Well, I first started, after my training, I first started going to sea, and I spent most of the 80s at sea as a navigator. And at the start of the 1980s, we were still navigating by sextant. So if you were out of sight of land, so let's say we're operating in the Tasman on our way to New Zealand, if the weather was bad and it was heavily clouded, you might not get any sun sights or star sights for 2 or 3 days. And that meant that by the time you get to New Zealand, you could easily be 60 miles from where you actually thought you were because you hadn't had a position. But not long after that, satellite navigation started to come in. Ultimately, it became current global positioning system, which everyone's got in their phone and watches these days. But it made an enormous difference because suddenly you knew very precisely where you were all the time. And that was not what navigation was like when I started doing it.
So what was the process when the clouds went away of actually figuring out where in the world you were?
Well, I mean, all the time you're dead reckoning. So you're working, you know where you've started, you know your courses, your speeds and so on. So you can calculate where you are. But of course, the ocean currents are taking you all over the place. And back in the, even in the 80s, our knowledge of the ocean currents was not very good. In fact, GPS and precise positioning was one of the things that enabled us to determine much more accurately what the currents were doing. But no, with a sextant, you're basically taking the altitudes of stars and the sun, and that enables you to develop position lines, which you can then intersect to determine quite precisely where you are in good conditions, to within half a mile or so. Bad conditions, not nearly so good.
and that's something like what our watches are doing, isn't it? They're tracking the position of various satellites in the sky and calculating, therefore, the lines that intersect between them.
Yes, I mean, the mathematics involved in GPS is extraordinarily complicated. I don't begin to understand that, but it's a remarkable system.
How does that change how you look at the world, being a navigator?
Well, it's... for me, it's historically interesting. It's a bit humbling to look back to navigators like Cook and Flinders and think about how little they actually had. They were navigating in oceans that were completely unknown. I mean, right up until the early 20th century, there was no echo sounding. So you didn't know what the depth was unless you'd actually dropped a lead line over the side and measured it. And that's fine in shallow water, but if you're in 5 kilometres of ocean deep, you're not going to get a lead line to the bottom and find out how deep it is. So they knew absolutely nothing, really, about the oceans. And even by the 1980s, I remember one of the navigators I worked for as a young officer telling me how we were now starting to understand how much more complicated the ocean currents were than we actually thought they were. So the Gulf Stream, everyone knows that flows across the Atlantic. But actually, it's not just a steady flow all in one direction. It's much more complicated than that. Here, the East Australian Current, that's in the news quite a lot. When I started, it was basically regarded as just a strong 4-knot current that flowed all the way down the East Australian coast. But after we start getting satellite imagery and things like that, we realise that it's actually a series of eddies that move down the coast. So in some places you can be getting set to the north. In other places you're racing to the south. But we didn't really understand that in the early 80s and before. It's a relatively recent thing that we've come to understand.
As we get towards the late 80s, you must have had young navigators coming through. Did they know how to use the sextant and the old materials, or did they just abandon that for the new technology?
We continued to teach the use of a sextant. Back in the 80s, everyone, all seamen officers, did it to greater and lesser degrees of success. Now, our specialist navigators do still learn how to use a sextant, but how often they actually get out there and take star sights and so on, I'm not sure. I mean, I retired 10 years ago, so I'm a little out of date on that now.
It's there just in case the ship loses all power.
Yes.
You know, and you know your phone is no longer responding to you.
Yes.
Should there be a nuclear event, you can still figure out where your ship is. You can't steer it anywhere by that point. But now, what are some of the highlights of your career? If you look back over being a naval officer for decades, what do you see as the things that still are fierce in your memory?
Well, I mean, as a seaman officer, one of your ambitions tends to be command of your own ship.
Yep.
I was fortunate enough to command the second HMAS Brisbane, which was one of the last steam ships and one of the first guided missile destroyers. And I commanded her for a couple of years in the late 90s. And that's a very humbling experience, commanding your own ship. I mean, it is one of the jobs where even though you have enormous support from ashore, you're still very much on your own, and you are responsible for that ship and all the people in her to a huge extent. And it's very demanding. It's also great fun. It's enormously satisfying. So command is all. If you talk to any seaman officer in the Navy, command is going to be one of those things that really leaves an impression. I guess the other highlight I'd mention as a after command, I was in sort of higher headquarters, and I was sent off to Bandar Aceh after the Boxing Day tsunami in 2004 to run the maritime component. We took a ship up there loaded with army heavy equipment to help the Indonesians clear away and recover after that awful disaster. I mean, nearly 250,000 people died around the rim of the Indian Ocean. Mm. And the hardest hit city of all was Bandar Aceh.
What was it like when you arrived there? What did the city look like?
Well, it was interesting because I actually flew in. I didn't come up with the ship. I joined the ship later. And we flew into the airport and we drove into Bandar Aceh. And on the shoreward side, the first part of the city we drove through, it was just like an Indonesian city. The markets were running, people everywhere, bit of earthquake damage around, but not much more. But then you got into the centre of the city where the furthest reaches of the tsunami had come, and it was deserted, huge damage. And then you got a little further on, and you're still 2 or 3 kilometres from the shore, and there was absolutely nothing. It was just flat mud flats as far as you could see, because everything had just been swept away. Quite extraordinary, and very, very sad.
So what was the job you were there then to do with your heavy equipment?
Well, our specific job was to, as the Navy component, was to actually get Army ashore with their heavy equipment so that they could clear away. I mean, there were, I think the American relief effort was the biggest effort. The Abraham Lincoln was offshore, and she and her supporting ships were flying helicopters in with aid continuously throughout the time I was there for weeks. Our job was that we had a fairly small area, Bandar Aceh hospital and surrounds, and basically we put the army equipment and some of our own people in to help clear that away so that the area could be used again and rebuilt. I mean, little things. Well, one of the first things we did was establish water purification because there was no clean water in Bandar Aceh.
Yep.
And that doesn't sound, you know, just putting a few purifiers in place, but the ability to provide fresh water to people was actually extraordinarily important.
If you don't have the basics, you have nothing.
Indeed.
If you don't have clean water and a sewage system that works, you are just rife with disease and starvation.
So. Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
So you have this incredible career in the Navy. What makes you think I'm going to settle in Woodbridge in Tasmania?
Well, I guess I wanted to continue to do some work with Navy, but I knew I could do that remotely as a reservist or as a consultant. And we'd spent the last 20 years, we brought our children up in Canberra. And I sort of commuted to different jobs in Sydney and so on and so forth as required. But having done that for a long time, we just basically, my wife and I wanted to do something different. And we'd always loved Tasmania, not that we had any formal connection to it at all. So we looked around when I knew my career in the permanent force was coming to an end and decided that Woodbridge looked rather nice. So we basically took a leap into the wild blue yonder and bought a house in Woodbridge, and we've been there ever since.
Look, I can't argue with you about it because I made exactly the same move from Canberra to Tasmania myself, a dozen odd years ago. And you're part of the Village Green Project, which is kind of putting history on show in a park in town.
Yeah, that's right. A couple of years ago, the Community Association in Woodbridge was donated a block of land in the centre of the village to turn it into a park. So the aim is to make a very nice park overlooking the channel. It's a beautiful location. But also we're putting in a whole range of history panels which talk about the history of the area going right back to the end of the last ice age when the D'Entrecasteaux Channel wasn't a channel at all. It was a river valley. because the sea level was 120 metres lower than it is today. So we're going through all of that. We're trying to cover the story of the Aboriginal people of the area, the colonial period, the industries and so on, the apple industry, scalloping in the channel, all those kind of things. And then also to talk about the legacy of war, because having gone through all the historical panels, the last piece of the project is a memorial wall to talk about the people who went off to fight for Australia. And also, of course, the people who stayed behind to keep the home fires burning. We're working through that at the moment and hope to have that pretty much completed by the end of this year.
Oh, fantastic. Well, look, a beautiful public park overlooking a river is always a lovely amenity to have in your town. Peter, thank you so much for coming in to talk with me. Who are you going to handball me onto?
I've suggested a chap called Greg Jeffries, who's very well known in Woodbridge. And Greg is a very interesting character, but most recently he's been spending a lot of time helping people who have suffered from hepatitis C gain access to some very effective drugs to help them with that that disease. But those drugs are difficult to acquire in Australia, or at least cost a vast amount of money at the moment. So he's got some interesting ways of acquiring them from overseas. I shouldn't say any more, otherwise I'll take his thunder.
I look forward to meeting him soon. Peter Leshen, great to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Joel.